This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 28, 2004. I'm Nell Abram. The United States hands over sovereignty to Iraq 2 days ahead of schedule. The U.S. Supreme Court deals the White House a blow regarding detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The Green Party nominates David Cobb as its presidential candidate. And 70,000 Argentine demonstrators march in Buenos Aires to commemorate the deaths of two activists killed 2 years ago and to protest current police repression. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Amma Bouadi with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. On Sunday in Mexico, an estimated 350,000 people, according to the Salt Lake Tribune, took part in a peaceful, silent protest march through the heart of Mexico City to protest kidnappings, violent crimes, and the failures of law enforcement to stop or fully investigate these crimes. The march was the largest in Mexico's recent history. Marchers wore black ribbons in memory of victims killed during the kidnappings and robberies, and rather than chant, protesters shared stories of people who had been victims of violent crime. Human rights groups say there's been a rise in the number of deaths of kidnapped victims in the country. One estimate puts the number of those kidnapped at 4,000 people between 1997 and 2003. Local reports say that the administration of Vicente Fox is pushing for Congress to give kidnappers longer jail terms and revamp the justice system. 11 states have filed a formal challenge to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's proposed mercury emissions reduction rule, which backs away from minimum requirements in the Federal Clean Air Act and slows the timetable to achieve significant reductions of the highly toxic pollutant. Catherine Krupnik has more.
Tomorrow will be the last day the Environmental Protection Agency will hear public opinion on the proposed Clean Air Mercury Rule. The rule will permanently cap emissions from coal-fired power plants and provide companies with flexibility to achieve early reductions of mercury. However, there has been some debate about the existence of technology to reduce mercury levels. Frank O'Donnell, Executive Director of Clean Air Trust, says that indeed the technology does exist.
There is growing evidence that there are a number of different technologies that could reduce mercury emissions significantly over the course of the next 3 or 4 years.
Currently, activated carbon injections are being used to aid in the process of mercury reduction. There are products in demonstration and test phases that are set to hit the market in 2005. O'Donnell says that it is the role of the government to set standards which will aid the companies to get their products out there. To post your comment before tomorrow's deadline, go to the EPA's website at epa.gov and click on Law, Regulations, and Dockets. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Catherine Krupnik.
At least 3 Israelis and 4 Palestinians were killed in a series of back-and-forth attacks today. Lala El-Haddad reports.
2 Israeli settlers were killed and many more wounded when 2 homemade Palestinian missiles fell on the Jewish settlement of Sderot, east of Gaza, earlier today. The attack came just hours after Israeli helicopter gunships fired 10 missiles at the Ha'il Zeitoun neighborhood in Gaza City, destroying a foundry and injuring Palestinian bystanders in the process. Late last night, 1 Israeli soldier was killed and several others injured after a 150-kilogram bomb was detonated under an Israeli military outpost near the illegal settlement block of Rosh Hatif in the central Gaza Strip. The Islamic resistance group Hamas claimed responsibility for the attack. In addition, Israeli troops destroyed a number of Palestinian houses and razed areas of agricultural land in the central Gaza Strip. Residents were ordered to leave their houses without removing their belongings, according to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. The Gaza Strip has been divided into 3 isolated segments as a result of the various attacks, forcing Palestinian commuters to ride donkey carts along the coast or walk a distance of 3 kilometers in order to pass through the checkpoint leading into the city. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, I'm Leila El-Haddad.
This week, Secretary of State Colin Powell travels to Sudan under increasing pressure to recognize the genocide taking place in the country's Darfur region. Andre Banks has more on this story.
Colin Powell's trip marks the highest-level U.S. visit to Sudan since 1978. Many have demanded a stronger stance against the government in Khartoum for orchestrating the violence in Darfur. Amidst comparisons to the tragically delayed recognition of genocide in Rwanda 10 years ago, Powell and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who will join him in Darfur on Wednesday, have acknowledged the escalating violence, but they have failed to put sustained pressure on the government in Khartoum to stop the killings and provide access to humanitarian agencies. The United Nations has declared that this region of Western Sudan now faces the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The genocide unfolding in Darfur also threatens the peace deal that many hoped would end the 21-year civil war between Sudanese in the north and south. Today, a representative of one of the warring factions has reportedly refused to join a coalition government as long as it is involved in perpetuating the violence in Darfur. This threat, along with pressure from human rights activists, including an online petition at www.africaaction.org, has garnered 20,000 signatures in 2 weeks and has put pressure on POW and other officials to declare what is happening in Darfur genocide, an action that would obligate the U.S. and 130 other countries to prevent and punish the atrocities. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andre Banks.
And I'm Amma Bouadi with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
A surprise ceremony marking the transfer of some powers of state from the occupation authority to an appointed Iraqi government took place this morning. U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer left the country by early afternoon, by which time Interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi was on television, vowing continued action against anti-occupation guerrillas. David Enders has this report from Baghdad.
The reaction to the announcement the transfer had taken place was similar to the announcement of the members of the interim government last month. People remained unimpressed and detached. Iraqis won't have the chance to vote for leaders until January at least, and many expect violence to continue in the country for some time. The transfer was reportedly moved up to avoid expected attacks, and most press were not informed. In fact, an email was sent from the press center this morning reminding journalists to update credentials before upcoming transfer-related events. Though the date was moved up and held in an undisclosed location to, quote, catch the bad guys off guard, as one U.S. military official put it, fear was still one of the reactions. American journalist Christian Parenti was at a water plant in North Baghdad when the news broke.
Basically, everybody, as soon as they heard this, got the order to leave and vacate the premise because they're near a military base and they receive mortar fire occasionally. They got mortared 8 times yesterday on and near the premise. So it was pretty much just like a ghost town. There was a few engineers and a few guards, and they showed me around, and everybody else like split.
After more than 3 decades of military dictatorship, 3 wars, a decade of sanctions, and more than a year of occupation, many Iraqis have adopted a sort of fatalism toward yet another unelected set of leaders and expressed hopes things would get better. Taxi driver Abu Ahmed.
We wish to live in safety and security. That's all we want, nothing else. All people are asking for the same thing, security and safety. I think that Iyad Alawi is good. There are more policemen in the streets. I've been looted 3 times while driving my taxi. I have 5 children, a wife, a mother. It doesn't matter who our leader is. We would like all those who are unemployed to have jobs.
The capture of Saddam Hussein in December was an event that brought Iraqis out into the streets, shedding tears and firing weapons in the air in celebration of defiance toward the U.S. But the streets in Baghdad will likely be quiet tonight, as more attacks on the new government and U.S. forces are expected.
Tonight I'll stay home, even if there is not a curfew, but I am very optimistic about what will happen. God bless us.
Members of militia groups do not see the transfer as a reason to stop fighting. Members of Muqtada al-Sadr's Jaish al-Mehdi militia in Baghdad said they will continue to oppose the U.S. presence, despite orders from al-Sadr to hold a ceasefire. Abu Muqtada was a resistance member when Saddam Hussein was in power and spent 2 years in prison.
It is all the same. There were broken promises before, there are broken promises now. It is like they think they are talking to children.
Ahmed is another Sadr supporter.
Iyad Alawi is taking his right from the Americans. He is an agent who left Iraq and rode back in on American tanks. And anyone who came on American tanks, we consider them an agent. Any decision that is taken by the Americans should not be followed. We did not follow the governing council.
It seems, however, that efforts will continue to provide a smokescreen of Iraqi authority. Iraqi leaders also said yesterday that it is likely Saddam Hussein will be released from U.S. to Iraqi custody later this week, though added foreign troops will be needed to guard the building where he will be held. In Baghdad, this is David Enders reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The man who'll be running Iraq's new government, Iyad Alawi, is a former Ba'athist and CIA agent. Beginning in 1991, with an order signed by the first President Bush, Alawi, along with his organization, the Iraqi National Accord, was promoted by the Saudi government as the answer to Saddam Hussein and was funded by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. Alawi, a former Iraqi intelligence chief, attempted a military coup in 1996, also funded by the CIA, but failed. Free Speech Radio news correspondent Aaron Glantz has more on Iraq's new prime minister.
Yeah, it's a sign that we're ready to go, it's a proud moment. It really is for the Iraqi people.
President George W. Bush speaking at the conclusion of the NATO summit in Istanbul. But the transfer of official sovereignty hardly means America is ready to let go. In addition to the 150,000 U.S. troops stationed in Iraq that will still answer to Washington, the Bush administration has, through its appointed governing council, put in place a prime minister sure to continue an unpopular occupation. Iraq's new head of government, Iyad Alawi, is a former Ba'athist whose organization has received billions of dollars from the CIA and the British MI6. Imad Kaduri, a former Iraqi nuclear scientist who, like Alawi, defected from Iraq during Saddam's presidency, says Alawi is similar to Ahmed Chalabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress who got millions of dollars from the CIA and the Pentagon, but who has since lost Washington support.
Now, in my understanding, a party should have an agenda, should have a program. Neither Chalabi nor Alawi have these things. All they're agents of intelligence agencies. Therefore, they are devoid of any such political content. That really begs the question, what's your agenda? Serving British intelligence? Serving CIA intelligence? Is that your agenda? Is that your aim? Is that your goal? Is that how you want to persuade people to join you?
In response to allegations that he is a tool of the CIA, Iyad Alawi told reporters this month his organization has been in contact with intelligence services from at least 15 countries. He said he was proud of those countries' support for removing Saddam Hussein. Like Alawi, many of the members of his party, the Iraqi National Accord, are Ba'athist defectors from Saddam's regime, many of them former army generals or intelligence figures. They used the money they got from the CIA in failed attempts at anti-Saddam military coups. Chris Tonzing is editor of the Washington-based Middle East Report.
Another message that the choice of Alawi may send to Iraqis is that the preferred Iraqi sovereigns, if you will, of the United States are military men, are people who have a history of serving as part of an apparatus that governed Iraq with an iron hand. And this may send that signal to Iraq that this may be the prelude to the U.S. exiting Iraq only if it can turn over the reins to another strongman.
Other analysts are upset but resigned to Alawi's connections to the CIA. Connie Zulam heads up the American Kurdish Information Network.
But America is there right now, I guess, and CIA is there, and you're not going to have a choice there that's not approved by CIA. I personally would have preferred a voice that was not in bed with CIA. I, knowing the politics of the region and knowing CIA's involvement with shadowy figures, I personally wouldn't recommend somebody who's closely associated with CIA.
Iraqi scientist Imad Kaduri says, given his CIA contacts, it will be difficult for Iyad Alawi's government to curtail resistance activity and increase security so elections can be held in January.
Because the Iraqi resistance, the patriotic national resistance, they will not lay down their arms as long as they are occupiers in Iraq. Therefore, I would recommend to any prime minister who would take this kind of position to couple the holding of elections with the departure of occupying forces from Iraq.
But that's not the view taken by Iyad Alawi. During the official handover ceremony, he echoed statements coming from Washington and labeled anti-occupation insurgents terrorists. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
For archives of the newscast, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. The U.S. Supreme Court issued its first major ruling affecting President Bush's war on terror today. The High Court dealt the administration a setback in its detention policies with U.S. citizens and the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The court did rule the administration has the right to detain U.S. citizen Yasser Hamdi and 600 detainees at Guantanamo Bay, but the justices also ruled the detainees have the right to challenge their detainments in U.S. courts. Mitch Jezerich has more from the Supreme Court.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down decisions that while agreeing with the Bush administration that enemy combatants can be detained, it cannot deny many of them the right to challenge the detainment in U.S. courts. The cases involve Saudi-born U.S. citizen Yasser Assam Hamdi, who was accused of fighting alongside the Taliban in the 2001 Afghan invasion and who is being held on a naval brig in South Carolina, and 14 foreign detainees held in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
The executive branch had asserted that it alone had the right to decide about the detention and treatment of these prisoners, and the court said no.
Elisa Massimino is a lawyer with the group Human Rights First that helped develop amicus briefs in support of Hamdi and detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
The government was asserting the right to put prisoners in Guantanamo, or whether they're enemy combatants, so-called detained U.S. citizens detained inside the United States, in a kind of legal black hole where the only rights they were granted were those that the executive branch felt like giving them. The Supreme Court has rejected that in two of these cases, saying that that detainees must have access to an independent authority, the judiciary, in order to determine the legality of their detention.
By an 8-1 ruling in the case of Hamdi, the Supreme Court said that a citizen held as an enemy combatant must be allowed to contest the factual basis for the detention. In the majority opinion, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote that a state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens. The dissenting opinion came from Justice Clarence Thomas. The Supreme Court also ruled on a similar case of Jose Padilla, who was accused of conspiring to set off a dirty bomb and who is also being held on a naval brig in South Carolina. In a 5-4 ruling, the court sent Padilla's case back to a federal court, saying Padilla's lawyers filed his habeas corpus petition in the wrong district. In the Guantanamo Bay ruling, the Supreme Court said that two Australians and 12 Kuwaitis being held there also have the right to challenge their detainment in U.S. courts. Attorney Joe Margolis represents the detainees.
It is now incumbent upon the United States to demonstrate through a fair process that they have a right to hold these people. And if they cannot, then all these people have to be released. Now, if they can, then we will have the benefit of the federal court to determine whether that process is fair and to supervise the administration of that process.
The Supreme Court rejected the Bush administration's argument that the 600 foreign detainees at Guantanamo Bay had no right to habeas corpus because Cuba retained sovereignty over the base while the U.S. is leasing it. The court ruled, however, that Guantanamo Bay is still functionally part of the U.S. Margolis talks of the next steps for his clients there.
We will go into federal district court. We will move very quickly to seek access to our clients, something that has been denied them from the beginning of this litigation. And we anticipate that there will be, the next step is for the government to answer our allegations. Our position is and has always been that our clients did nothing to justify their detention. And it is now incumbent upon the United States in a federal district court to justify the lawfulness of their detention through competent proof that we will have the opportunity to challenge through all dimensions of due process.
It's still unclear how the rulings will affect all of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, including for Australian David Hicks, who is expected to face a military commission. It's also unclear how the Bush administration will respond and whether it will continue to bring detainees to Guantanamo Bay now that they may have a legal recourse. Also unclear is whether these rulings will set a precedent concerning detainees held in U.S. custody throughout the world. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
In a closely fought race for the presidential endorsement of the Green Party, California lawyer David Cobb narrowly defeated Ralph Nader this weekend. In his acceptance speech at the convention in Milwaukee, Cobb said that Americans are living under a legal, economic, and political system that is literally destroying the planet.
90-95% of the world is being oppressed in creating a racist, sexist world order with the plunder. So not only are we on a suicide death march if we don't stop ourselves, in the process, we are brutally oppressing most of the people of this world. And the thing, like, so that's all really bad. And the thing, I guess, I don't know what, maybe it's just me, but the thing that really just gets to me is it masquerades as a democracy when in point of fact it's a plutocracy. Right? We're going over a cliff. We're being oppressed. And then they said, well, it's a democracy. You're in control. No, it's not. And one of the things that the Green Party is doing is creating a space in a political party for us to tell the truth.
Patricia LaMarche, a Green Party activist from Maine, was named the vice presidential candidate. Many who back a safe state approach in the 2004 presidential election supported the Cobb-LaMarche ticket. Safe states are those in which either the Republican or Democratic candidates have a clear lead in the polls. In swing states, Cobb and LaMarche plan to ask their supporters to vote their conscience. Free Speech Radio News spoke with Donna Warren today. She's a coordinator with Greens for Nader and is a member of the National Board of Directors for Pacifica Radio. She was at the convention and describes the mood on the convention floor as contentious. Donna Warren, what are your thoughts about the safe state approach to campaigning?
The Cobb campaign to not campaign in swing states and to only campaign in safe states is a capitulation to the Democratic Party. In fact, they're working closely with the Democrats to ensure that Kerry is not defeated in 2004. The Nader-Kamejo ticket doesn't believe in campaigning only in safe states. We want to reach out to all the people, and already 10 million Americans support Nader-Kamejo, and so I believe that the 10 million Americans is much more relevant than the 408 Cobb Green Democrats who nominated him as their candidate.
What was the reaction on the floor when David Cobb garnered enough delegates to gain the nomination?
Cobb picked LaMarche as his running mate. She's a European American. David Cobb is a European American, and that really slapped the people of color who were at the convention. We thought that it was pretty low down that they turned down Ralph Nader, an Arab American, and Peter Kamejo, a Latino, who represents the true values of the Green Party in our fight for diversity. And you said, was the convention contentious? Yes. As soon as Cobb reached the required 408 votes, hundreds of Greens, and I think about 637 delegates, hundreds of Greens got up and walked off the convention floor. And we met a little bit in another room, and people were going through postpartum depression, trying to get over the shock and trying to figure out how to run our campaign for Nader Kamejo. So now we are Greens for Nader.
Donna Warren is a member of the Black Caucus of the Greens and says that Cobb erroneously announced from the podium that he had the support of the caucus. What do you think the outcome of the convention bodes for the party in general?
I think that David Cobb and the Green Democrats did the party a great disservice by not allowing us as Greens to stand up for the values that we think, that we say we're for the diversity, for global humanity.
That was Greens for Nader coordinator and Pacifica board member Donna Warren. More than 70,000 people took to the streets in Argentina calling for justice on the second anniversary of the massacre of the bridge Pueyrredón, where two piqueteros were murdered by the police. Matt Goldin has more from Buenos Aires.
June 26, 2002, marked a strike amongst unemployed organizations coordinated known as the National Workers' Assembly. Among their demands, they sought to increase the amounts of the social benefits, to stop the criminalization of popular activists, and to demonstrate in solidarity with workers who took back their factories. They blocked several bridges to and from the city of Buenos Aires. A few weeks earlier, President Eduardo Duhalde's work minister, Alfredo Atanasov, announced that they will not allow any street or bridge blockades. In an attempt to avoid picketeros, the government militarized access through the use of 3 security forces. Nevertheless, activists were determined to make their voices heard. Shortly after 12 p.m. June 26, a brutal repression began that is known today as the massacre of Pueyrredón Bridge.
I don't need time. I don't need time. You are the ones who need time. It is now 11:35. In 5 minutes, I will have to suppress you if you continue with this blockade.
That day, 2 years ago, Darío Santillán and Maximiliano Costecchi were murdered and 33 others injured by gunshot wounds. Since that day, the 26th of every month, their fellow friends and family blocked the Pueyrredón Bridge, claiming justice.
We are going to continue coming here every 26th and every year anniversary to keep remembering them. We do not want these murders to remain unpunished.
Only 3 police officers have been arrested so far in the case. Security forces operated to repress the picketeros under orders given from executive powers. Today, picketeros not only claim punishment for those who carried out the repression, they also want an investigation into government participations in the planning of this brutal act. Current President Néstor Kirchner has met with picketeros and promised to create an investigative commission. 2 years later, nothing has happened. The relatives and victims of those killed and injured created their own commission and denounced not only former President Eduardo Duhalde, but also called current President Kirchner a liar. Alberto Santillán is here expresses his disappointment with Kirchner.
The government has demonstrated that it doesn't have the political intention of investigating the people in charge politically. President Kirchner has lied, telling me that he is going to create an investigative commission, but he has not.
This past weekend, a diverse set of actions took place. They began on June 25 with the blockade of Pueyrredón Bridge and a protest at the doors of the State Secretary of Intelligence.
We are here at the doors of the Secretary of the State Intelligence, denouncing them because of the way that they perpetuate the process. It's from this building that repression was controlled. We're here now calling the police chief's cell phone, who was in charge the evening that Darío and Maxi were murdered.
More than 70,000 people, including the families of the victims, gathered in a mass march this Saturday to demand an end to impunity. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Our producers are Simba Rousseau, Monica Lopez, and Deepa Fernandez. The headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman. Our D.C. editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millian, and Lindsay Benedict. We have help from Bob Stern, Arlette Cohn, and Amma Boadi. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. To find out more or for archives of the newscast, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. I'm Nell Abram.